maintenance, scheduled maintenance, and repair service, including a nationwide warranty by ASE-certified technicians. Located near the U of I campus with shuttle service available. More information is available at 367-0300.
This is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. This is hour number two of the program. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be speaking with a physician who has spent a lot of his professional career traveling around the world and working some here in the United States on the subject of infectious disease. His name is Gary Slutkin, and he's professor of epidemiology and international health at the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. He's trained in infectious disease control and reversing epidemics. After he graduated from med school, he went to the med school at University of Chicago. He went out to San Francisco to do his internship and residency. And in the early 80s, he ran the tuberculosis program for the city of San Francisco. After that, he went to Somalia in East Africa, and he spent 3 years there. And when he was there, he worked on cholera and tuberculosis epidemics and also became assistant to the director of primary health care for the country. After that, he was recruited by the World Health Organization Global Program on AIDS, where he was assigned responsibility for supporting the Uganda AIDS epidemic. He also supported the work of the AIDS program in Thailand, and he lived and worked overseas for 10 years in a number of places, including Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, Congo, Zaire, and over 15 other places. When he came back to the United States in 1995, he decided that he wanted to work on a little bit different problem and see if he could apply his skills and his experience to a problem that arguably is a public health problem, but a little bit different than the kinds of things that he had been dealing with before, because the problem he decided he wanted to work on was violence. In addition to being a professor there at University of Illinois Chicago, he is also executive director of the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention and also something called Ceasefire Illinois. And we'll be talking about that, these programs, and generally about violence prevention and the idea of violence as a public health issue, something that you can attack in part, at least, with some of the same kind of tools that you might apply to other public health problems. As we talk this morning, questions are welcome. Questions are always welcome, questions and comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening in Chicago, for example, or any place else around Illinois or Indiana, or even any place in the country, if you'd happen to be listening on the internet, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Slutkin, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
Great,
thanks.
Thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time today.
Thank you, I appreciate being with you.
Well, how was it that you decided that of all of the things that you would concentrate on, and I'm sure that this is not the only thing that that you're doing, but that you would make the shift away from dealing with infectious disease, which is something that for, it sounds like, for a lot of your medical career, this had been a major focus of your kind of work, from working on that to growing to something that, while it had some parallels, it's really different.
Yeah, you're asking why I went from working on infectious diseases to working on violence. And as you know, I think I'm a public health epidemiologist, which means I work on epidemics. To me, violence is an infectious disease. It behaves almost exactly like all other infectious diseases. If the spread occurs from one to another, to another, to another. If you look at what happened in Rwanda, you see a kind of epidemic curve from no violence to great violence to it dropping off. If you're thinking about a soccer riot, it's the same thing. The violence behaves very much like an infection. And even, you know, if someone does it to you, then you do it to somebody else, which is the same way that, for example, colds or flu is spread. So I principally saw it as an epidemic type of a problem, an infectious type of a problem, not as a problem of good people or bad people, but of something that kind of bounces off of people that they integrate and then transmit. And I guess that was one of the principal reasons I just saw the thing different. And I guess the other thing to say is, since I was working overseas for so many years, you develop when you're overseas a kind of view of the United States, and it's not the same view that America has of itself. The view that you see from abroad of the U.S. is as a place that doesn't actually have a lot of problems, but there's two things that kind of stand out. Again, looking from the outside as someone who was working for World Health and consulting to Uganda or Thailand or Holland or you could say the U.S., so, well, what's going on in the U.S.? Well, there's two main issues. One is this individualism, competitiveness, aggressiveness, and violence, which is rather unusually manifest in the U.S. And then you see this problem of distribution of resources. In other words, a lot going to the wealthy and a very, very little going to the poor. And these are principally the only substantial matters, or everything else kind of flows from this, because you see the U.S. is a place that otherwise, if you were to look at it, should be quite fine. I mean, the land is excellent. The climate is excellent. There's plenty of food. There's plenty of opportunity for growth of food. So these were there's these two matters, if you will. One is viewing the U.S. as basically only having these two matters that needed to be sorted out. And secondly, I'm seeing one of these matters, the violence one, as being principally a public health infectious process that needed a new strategy. This is a big part of it. It really needed a new strategy. Our program, the ceasefire program, and the approach that we're using, it fundamentally looks at violence in an entirely different way. It doesn't look at it as a matter of good people and bad people and individual crime. It really looks at it more as a matter of a behavior that's principally learned and principally maintained by social pressures in the neighborhood, pretty much like all behavior. So we fundamentally look at it differently, and the approach to it is fundamentally different. It's more of one that's trying to change the social pressure equation. And that's why we're getting these good results, is because the strategy that's being applied really intercepts the violence in a way that makes sense to those who are doing it.
Mm-hmm. This, I think one of the things that's really interesting here, and maybe also a challenge for you, is that in approaching violence in this way, the way that you have just explained, talking about the violence being something that is learned, it is a learned behavior, you're going against what the perception that I'm sure a lot of people have, and that is that bad people are not bad because of what they do. They're bad because of who they are. That is somehow violence. There is this common belief that violence is so ingrained in some individuals that it is something that you can't change, and that for that reason there's not a whole lot that you can do about it other than take a very kind of aggressive law enforcement approach and do everything that you can to remove those people from society so that they cannot continue to commit violence. I think that there's just this general, a lot of people believe, you know, yes, there's violence and a bad thing, but there's nothing we can do about it except lock up the people who are responsible.
Yeah, and both of those thoughts are just basically incorrect. I mean, the thought that these are fundamentally bad people is incorrect, and the fact that there's nothing you can do about it is incorrect. I mean, let's just take the first one. The story on almost every person who is involved with violence is that they were a little sweet little baby and smiled and laughed and played and so on and so on. And then something happened, you know, either the parent mistreated the person or the street, you know, taught this person something. And then the person then became punished, which invariably makes things worse. And then without getting the kind of help and love and support, but with getting more you're no good and more punishment, you could not have developed a more perfect way of forming someone who is going to interact by lashing out than this system. And let me just say one other thing about this. So that the person is in the first place as a baby, as a child, without this type of an idea of being violent. Now, if you look at you're telling us and me and your listeners and so on that the common view is that people who are, for example, involved in gangs or whatever are bad and so on. We used to believe that people who had cancer were bad. We used to believe that people who had tuberculosis were bad. We used to believe that people who had mental illness, that's closer to the recent history, were bad until we realized that, you know, guess what, it's in a lot of people's families and it's an illness that requires a certain amount of therapy. I mean, people with seizure disorders were very, very commonly thought of as evil, and people threw stones at them. It still happens in many parts of the world. So a lot of our common views are basically subsequently found to be incorrect. They're just simply incorrect. People with TB have a microorganism that needs treatment. People who have cancer have something that went wrong in their cells, and they need treatment. Now, what about treatment? What about the second belief you mentioned, that there's nothing that can be done? Well, you know, how successful do you think we are at curing, and now I'm talking again as a doctor, curing diabetes or curing asthma or curing lung disease? In fact, we are not that successful. We're just simply managing it. But as a health cure, helping, caring community of hospitals, doctors, and then the larger community, we frankly don't stop trying. We don't stop trying. And so when we're unable to fully turn things around, we keep trying, and then it gradually gets better. And that's really what we're seeing with the people who we're taking care of, including people who have very substantial prior records, is that, you know, when we're hanging around them and working with them for about a year closely, you know, they pretty much turn themselves around. And some of them, within a couple years, are people who help turn other people around. So it's just this intensity of help that is required to succeed.
Let me introduce our guest here again for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit since we started out the program. We're talking this morning with Dr. Gary Slutkin. He is professor of epidemiology and international health at the University of Chicago the University of Illinois at Chicago School of Public Health. He is also executive director of the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention, which is based there, the School of Public Health, U of I Chicago. One of their programs is Ceasefire Illinois, which has gotten a lot of attention. His project, Chicago Project for Violence Prevention, has gotten a lot of attention nationally for its efforts to deal with violence and apply, as he explained at the beginning of the program, apply some of the same kinds of strategies that you might to infectious disease to the problem of violence in society. Questions, comments are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Maybe you could talk about how what you started when you first started out with the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention, what it was that you did.
Well, we started the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention in 1995. And between 1995 and 2000, we were, in a way, doing what you might call research with a small r. In other words, we were looking for who had succeeded with in reducing violence by using public health technologies of outreach or public education, messaging, community types of approaches. So we were kind of scanning the country, but really even the globe, for some successful models. And then we kind of took from public health the other things that have been used to change behavior. And this is pretty principally going back to the conversation that violence is just a behavior. And everything we do in public health has to do with behavior, whether it's trying to change sexual behavior or for AIDS, or trying to change drunk driving behavior, or trying to improve seatbelt using behavior or exercise behavior or eating behavior. This is all about behavior. So what are the behavior change technologies that seem to be most applicable? And then we kind of put a strategy together, which basically has five components. And we, in the year 2000, kind of gave it a go. And the go included outreach workers working late at night, community doing responses to every shooting, a lot of messaging with materials that tell you if you're aware a shooting might happen, be the one to stop it, call us, or if you're feeling pressure to shoot, call us. We had hotline, and the outreach workers would be interrupting shootings, and the outreach workers would be grabbing some people and talking with them and helping them change their thinking. And then we had the clergy working, and there's a piece of this that has to do with law enforcement presence. So there's a little more law enforcement presence in response to a shooting. So we have all these actors working, same messenger, multiple messengers, same message, no shooting, there's a better way, we don't do that anymore. And so we, in the year 2000, we gave it a go in West Garfield Park, the second worst police beat or worst neighborhood in Chicago. It had 43 shootings a year, and we dropped it down to 14 in the first year. We got a 67% drop. So our first 5 years, we're trying to figure things out as to what the components might be. And then in the year 2000, we gave it a go and got the 67% drop. Then in the year 2001, we got some funds from Senator Durbin, and which we distributed into three neighborhoods, and we got three intermediate results. And then gradually the governor saw what had been happening, Governor Blagojevich, and he got us to be able to expand the program so that we were in many more neighborhoods. And now we've been able to show this kind of a result in about six or eight neighborhoods, plus the town of Maywood, and now we're even hearing about some other recent reductions. So the years 2000 to 2005 have been pretty much the application and the improvement of the strategy and the duplication, the replication of the result.
So what do you think is really the key here to making this work?
Well, without a doubt, the outreach workers are the strongest part of this, because they're people who are hired from the same community and hired from the same group, who are highly credible to youth on the street or gang members or anyone who's out there who has gradually grown up with the idea that shooting is normal. And that's an important thing to keep in our minds, is that what a lot of people see as abnormal, like shooting another person, if you grow up in some areas and this is what's going on, you see it as normal. And so these outreach workers are talking with people and saying, you know, well, this really is not normal. This really doesn't make sense. This really doesn't make things better. You know, realize that if you use a gun, you know, this could result in a bad outcome for you. This could result in your being sorry you did it. If you were to go to prison, this could, you know, your mom would be very unhappy. You have kids. You'd be separated from them. And so we kind of help them save face and not do it. And so the outreach workers are actually intercepting shootings that might happen. And frequently, actually, people will, on the street, will tell us that their friend is angry at someone else. And, of course, they wouldn't call the police on their friend, but they'll call a ceasefire worker. A ceasefire worker will go out there and talk with everybody. Say, okay, you know, let's think this over. You know, the retaliation is not going to help the matter. And so we're just cooling down a lot of situations and then gradually changing the norm. And so if you think about, there's a lot of norms that have been changed. We used to smoke in, you know, in meetings, in public places, around each other, indoors. And now, you know, that's no longer normal. I mean, in fact, when I was in medical school, physicians would be smoking even while watching a patient's angiogram, a heart patient's x-rays of their narrowed vessels, that doctors would be smoking. Well, now that's no longer normal. So how does that happen? You know, gradually peer pressure, you know, from other doctors, from other friends, from, you know, the leaflets and flyers, from public information, from your parents, from your friends, you know, over and over, the peer pressure starts to go the other way. Because that's what's driving the shooting anyway, is, yeah, he shot you, you need to go get him, or you need to get his friend. That's peer pressure, see? And what we're doing is we're putting the peer pressure the other way. So wait a second, you don't have to do that. You're not really thinking. This doesn't make any sense. You know, what are you listening to her for? You know, this doesn't make anything any better. You're going to make it worse for yourself. You won't be able to take this back. And so we're giving them arguments so that are, in a way, new thoughts, and they make much more sense. So the outreach workers are the strongest piece. And then, you know, everyone else is doing it. The community makes a response to every shooting, so that reinforces. Every time there's a shooting, the community makes a big deal of it. That is not the way it used to be. It used to be no one did anything. Now the community comes out with big signs that say, stop killing people, don't shoot. And plus the clergy are talking to people. Plus they're getting all these flyers and leaflets. And it just keeps everywhere you look, you know, people are saying, no shooting, don't shoot. It doesn't make sense. Don't do it. And so then you start to see the change in the thinking. This is pretty much how we shifted toward, you know, gradually to be exercising more. People started to tell you, your friends started to exercise, go to the gym, so you go to the gym. You know, we're basically copiers and modelers. And people start eating more healthy, so then you say, well, I should be eating more healthy. You're going to put on a seatbelt because someone's going to look at you because you're stupid for not putting it on. And that's the same thing. And so that's really what drives our behavior. Our behavior is not principally driven by law enforcement. It's not principally driven by punishment. It's principally driven by social pressure.
Well, we have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? We'll start with someone in Charleston, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, lately I've evolved a couple of comments. I've evolved an idea of the human development, and we seem to be different, you know, from all the other species, that we go through the stages of development, three stages of infancy, of childhood, of juvenileism, and then adulthood. And somewhere along the way, we seem, through social pressures, to get stuck. And then with economic issues piled on top of that, the whole situation seems to me to become fairly unbearable. I'll finish with an illustration. I'm an old man now, but I have never forgotten this. I started school when I was 6 years old. And by the time I was in the third grade, I had a huge lesson given me by a fellow female student. You know, I had no idea about sexes and all that. I mean, the girls had long hair and the boys had short hair. But in any case, I came from extreme poverty. And between the times that I could speak and communicate and do all those other things, I didn't realize that I was hungry. That was the most apparent. Nor ragged or dirty. Well, the time I was in 9 years old, I had this person tell me, "Why do you stink? And why are your clothes ragged?" Well, I hadn't realized that up until then, but then it was a dawning. And I think somewhere in that given situation, throughout life, especially when we're separated by financial, it's not that a lot of rich people have problems too, but they're subjected to the same sort of development that we all are. But when the education, you're at a level where you can understand, or someone, as this little girl did for me, that I couldn't do anything about it. I was still ragged and dirty and hungry, but I realized I couldn't do anything about it and that I was actually that. So I don't know if that'll fit into your totality of what we're talking about today, but I wanted to relate that as an event that that I've never forgotten. I'll ring off and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. There's a couple interesting things that this wonderful gentleman has relayed to us that I'd just like to comment on briefly. One is this kind of, he describes the social pressure being unbearable and the differences between species. And I think there's something to this that has to do with the larger brain. And, I mean, first off, you know, we're not the only social animal. Ants are social animals and birds are and of course, monkeys are. But there's something that has caused us to be in this, in a way, higher anxiety frame. And, you know, it all comes from survival, you know, that you're afraid if you're really threatened. However, I think with our larger brain, we get afraid of things that are really not that threatening. And so we're ending up so frequently with, like, chronic stress disorders over things that are not threatening. In other words, even as a child, you know, we're in this culture, particularly taught, you know, you have to do good at school. This one test, you know, as a 10-year-old or a 7-year-old, is so important, as if you're going to die. And so and the brain, you know, only has a way of fearing. It doesn't have 1,000 ways of fearing, but it now has 1,000 different things it can be afraid of because it's arborized so much. I mean, there's so many different things to see that you can be afraid of, that whether you're in the rich world or the poor world or the white world or the black world, we're in a very high level of anxiety. And I think this is contributing a lot to people being, you know, withdrawing to themselves and not giving so much and adding to, you know, all of this inequity and so on. And so this business of unbearable relates to the anxiety circumstance. I mean, there's data now that shows that the level of anxiety of our teenagers today, in the average level, as measured on various tests, was only seen 30 or 40 years ago in people who, teenagers who were basically borderline, mentally ill in terms of their levels of fear, anxiety, and stress. And so I think this is relevant to our thinking about where we are now. And then he's talking about this rich people, poor people idea. Are you there?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
He was saying he didn't know he was poor until someone told him. And see, right now, this is another thing that magnifies. It's very hard to be poor right now and not, at least in the U.S., and not know it. I mean, because basically everybody can see the Sears building or the Hancock building. And there's this view, or from, you can see downtown, even no matter where you live and you've never been there. There's something out there that you don't have. And if you're watching television, which basically does emphasize wealthy people, if you're watching this, you are continuously shown what you don't have. Even people of middle class or higher are continuously bombarded with, you name it, the vacation you can't afford, the car you don't have, the woman or man you don't have, or whatever it is, you're continuously bombarded with what you don't have. And that has an effect on the mind, too, to cause dissatisfaction, which adds into this whole scene. So I think this is kind of like culturally where, in this country, we're struggling with almost a chronic dissatisfaction syndrome. This feeds into the violence because we're high-strung. We're high-strung. We're quick to react because we're always kind of, like a violin or a guitar or something, strung a little too tight.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, and we have some other callers. We're talking with Dr. Gary Slutkin. He's a physician trained in medicine and infectious disease control and reversing epidemics. He's professor of epidemiology and international health at the U of I Chicago School of Public Health. And he's worked on infectious disease issues at a number of places. He ran the tuberculosis program for the city of San Francisco in the early 80s. After that, he worked in Somalia on the problems of cholera and tuberculosis. He also worked for the World Health Organization and their global program on AIDS. He did work in Uganda and supported the work of the Thailand AIDS program. He also lived and worked in a number of other places over a decade, Kenya, Tanzania, Malawi, Congo, Zaire, other countries. And then when he came back here to the United States in the mid-90s, decided that he wanted to see if he could apply some of what he learned from working on infectious disease to the problem of violence. And in 1995, started the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention, which is based at the School of Public Health, U of I Chicago. And they developed this program that they call Ceasefire Illinois, which has been very effective in reducing violence, gun violence, in a number of places around Chicago. And it's gotten a lot of attention nationally as being an effective program. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in St. Charles. This is our line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. I was calling. I'm kind of on the other end. I work the grassroots organization, Justice for Juveniles, which we get involved after the kids have been sentenced to prison, and it's some of these kids have very long prison sentences, some serving life, but your program is really interesting, and I was just curious, with the outreach person, what sort of degree does that person have or need to have to be able to qualify for that type of work?
We don't have degree requirements.
Oh, okay.
And
is it volunteer or?
No, it's paid.
Okay.
This is we're talking about the ceasefire outreach worker, and the outreach worker is principally hired on. In other words, how do we select?
Yeah.
Select people who already know the population. They already may know a lot of people who are involved. However, they themselves are on this side of the line, clearly on this side of the line, have been on this side of the line for a while. And we know that by because we have some very excellent recruiters, people who also know what's going on. And we also ask law enforcement to kind of double-check that, to ensure that there isn't information that law enforcement would have that this person is still active, or was ever active for that matter. But 2/3 of our workers are people who do have prior offenses, and the other basic requirement is that they're very, if you will, hungry to do this, to help other people not make the mistakes or stop making the mistakes. And then, having so been selected, we have a rather substantial training program, supervision program, and support program. They're paid as full-time workers, and they work nights. They get benefits as well. So this is, in our view, a new cadre of worker, just like it used to be that, emergency medical technicians, years ago there was no such thing, now there is. There's health educators, AIDS educators, that didn't used to be such a cadre of worker. And so it's a profession, non-degreed, but we're getting to the point where we're about to be offering certifications and so on as well. Some of the people who have been working with us on this have been at it now for 5 or 6 years. Some who have progressed from outreach worker to supervisor, some have progressed from client to volunteer to outreach worker to supervisor. You know, just to say something about the degree stuff. There's a lot of very substantial problems in our cities and in the country that we're not effectively managing because we've professionalized the cure or the solution too much. And I think this we learned this in medicine by then developing a cadre of worker called nurse, and then a nurse assistant, and then as registered nurse and licensed nurse, and then there's a whole other category of paramedic and emergency medical technician. And so even in the drug treatment, for example, we have all these drug treatment providers that, do we have enough psychiatrists to deal with the hundreds of thousands of people who have drug addiction. So this paraprofessional categories of worker they need to be raised up and put into play to manage these problems that are of this type of scale.
So most of the people that you deal with are people who have either already been to prison or are on their way to prison or have a second chance?
It's something like this. This is the only way the real transformation can occur. Otherwise, the people who are trying to reach are at too great of a distance, communication-wise, psychology-wise, relationship-wise. It's easier.
So they're still out there on the street, more or less.
They know their way around. They know what's going on.
Yeah.
They know how to talk. They know how to listen. They know how to. They know what is going on. And this is a we don't do this to be nice, although I understand it is. it's because it is actually a proven public health technology. And we use sex workers to reach sex workers in the AIDS epidemic. We use Somali refugees to reach Somali refugees when we didn't have enough doctors. We found it easier to train a Somali refugee to be a doctor, a mini doctor, just taking care of the easier things, than to train doctors to know how to reach, interact with, and communicate with in the language the Somalis. Now that, of course, doesn't go all the way to surgery, because you have to have a continuum. But I think you get my point that at the point of contact, that point of contact is best done by people who are already close to that. But they need to be highly trained and supervised and supported and so on.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very
just
much.
Real quick, but I want to make sure I raise the question before we go on to some other callers, and we have a couple. You've had some success now, some documented success, applying this model in Chicago. Other people in other cities have tried this too?
Well, we're also applying it in Maywood, which is a western suburb outside of Chicago. And we've gone from 20 killings a year to 10 last year, and this year, 3 so far. And so we've been working with people in Newark, in Irvington, New Jersey, and I understand that they're getting a 30% drop in shootings and killings in the parts of Newark and Irvington that they've applied this. They've only began this in May of this year. And I also understand they've been trying everything they could think of without budging the problem since 1999. And we're just starting this up in Baltimore. And we're also working now with Aurora and Rockford and East St. Louis. These programs are in early stages.
Well, let's talk with someone else here listening, someone in Hoopston. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Enjoying the program quite a bit. Actually, you're speaking to an alum of the School of Public Health. Got my master's degree, so by all means, if you see Dr. Schwartzman, say hello to him for me.
Okay.
My comment was a quick one. I wanted to zero in on your comment, because I agree completely, about social pressure being reversed and being used for good reinforcement versus bad reinforcement, because I couldn't agree more. The comment I had, and I'll ask for your comment, I'll hang up and listen. About 4 or 5 years ago, Chicago Tribune did a project where each and every murder in Chicago was identified as to the victim and also as to who committed the crime when they could discover that. And unfortunately, the predominance on the west side and south side of Chicago is where most of the victims came to pass. And when the findings were brought to the attention of the black community, the leadership, unfortunately the response was, well, the Tribune was a racist paper, because it was kind of airing this dirty laundry in public. And I thought that was regrettable, because, you know, here were the findings, and, you know, perhaps we could work together on this. And I thought that was kind of taking a step back as opposed to forward. And I just was wondering if you could address that, where perhaps we could turn those attitudes, that situation around, to start making it a point where when the violence occurs, it's looked at as something negative as opposed to positive. And I'll go ahead and hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
I mean, our experience is that it is the African-American community that is taking leadership on reversing this situation in their own community, as it is the leadership in the Hispanic community that's taking leadership on reversing the problem in their community, and likewise for some other mixed communities that we have, for example, on the southwest side, where it's a mix of African-American, white, Hispanic, and some Middle Eastern residents as well. So I'm not directly aware of that, but the what the caller was referring to, but I'm very much saying that there's it's been the Black Caucus in the state legislature and the Latino Caucus in the state legislature that have really led the way on promoting the solution, the ceasefire solution, the community-driven solution for reversing the problem in these neighborhoods. So maybe there's been a change. I mean, it's the only way that it can happen is the formula for change, generally speaking, is something on the inside and something on the outside. It is pretty much what we see for many problems. This is our experience at World Health, whether we were working on the AIDS epidemic or cholera or whatever. There needs to be something on the outside that helps, gives a helping hand, gives a different perspective, and brings in some tools or technologies, and then it's the inside that works the people and works the problem around.
This the program and the strategy that you have outlined depends very, very heavily on, it's a grassroots kind of organization with community people being involved in solving the problem at a community level. One of the things I'm wondering about is what sort of role does law enforcement play in this, and do you involve, to what extent do you involve police officers and the other parts of the justice system in this, or do you think that they have particularly a role to play?
Yeah, law enforcement has a very important and substantial roles to play in reducing violence and in the ceasefire strategy that they helped us work out the strategy as well. But just a few things to mention that are fairly specific. I mean, one is that this has to do with the community responses to every shooting. Law enforcement notifies the ceasefire community organization of a shooting, and that initiates the community response itself. Whereas years ago, law enforcement would say, well, why should we tell you? You know, we'll take care of it, taking care of it meaning, catching the person. Now they've gone from that to being completely understanding of and supportive of and wanting to see the community respond. So they will initiate it by calling our community partner in the neighborhood, who then knocks on doors or calls people to bring out dozens or hundreds of residents to make a big deal of it. So law enforcement actually facilitates that and also participates in those responses. Secondly, law enforcement can be very, very effective messengers of the no shooting, no violence, ceasefire message without having to do enormous numbers of arrests and busts and so on, which they still, they still have to enforce the law, and there's various things that they need to do. But when law enforcement makes additional police presence because a shooting happened there, and then they're talking with residents saying, listen, we're here because there was a shooting, because there's no shootings here, we don't allow any shootings, they're adding some specificity to what they're about. In other words, we're not here because we don't like you. We're not here because, we hate your gang. We're not here because we're out to get this or that. We're here because, and this is the message, the shooting isn't acceptable here. And every time there's going to be a shooting, we're going to be here in a larger presence. And that might be both reassuring to the residents and also, a little disruptive sometimes to some of what the young people are doing, but it causes them to then, scratch their heads and go, wait, I see. This is about they're being serious that there's no shooting. And then you see it's one cloth of multiple messengers, same message, everyone in a way on the same page, the community, the leaflets and flyers, the outreach workers, the clergy, law enforcement, all saying there's no shooting here. Don't you understand? There's no shooting here. The ceasefire zone. We don't do this anymore.
Has the level of public attention that you've gotten, attention raging all the way up to the White House? I know, for example, back in June, the First Lady was in Chicago and you were on a panel with her talking about what it is that you do. Has that been good? I would imagine it probably has been good for your program to have that kind of level of visibility and the endorsement of the First Lady.
Well, certainly. And you may or may not know, the program was in Washington last week because Mrs. Bush had a full-day conference with all of the cabinet secretaries and a lot of the senior people in government to highlight a number of programs that seem to be getting results, that seem to have good documentation, that would have a substantial benefit to today's young people. In the State of the Union address this year, January of this year, the president announced that Mrs. Bush was going to be leading an initiative to help America's youth. And so even last week they did a kind of more formal kickoff, and we made a presentation, and I got a chance to talk with Mrs. Bush again about it. And I think they're serious about trying to make some positive change among this population that has otherwise been pretty well ignored. So we're optimistic. For us, the attention is important, not only because, you know, we want to do more of this work and see the effects of it and just basically allow these neighborhoods to put all this shooting behind ourselves so that the neighborhoods can, like, emerge again. And this is the main thing. But it's also, it gives us an opportunity to, you know, in a way give the new idea about how to deal with this. Yeah. Because the old idea has not worked. It hasn't worked, whether we're talking about wars or whether we're talking about all these very, very high levels of arrests and punishments, and they basically, someone who goes into prison comes out of prison. They don't come out better. We're paying so much. The costs are unbelievable.
We're, pardon me for jumping on you there, but we're going to have to stop because, I'm a little bit past my time. Just before we go, I do want to tell people if you're interested in finding out more about Ceasefire Illinois, there is a website. It's www.ceasefirechicago.org. And our guest this morning, Dr. Gary Slutkin, he's the executive director of the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention based at the School of Public Health at the U of I Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The broadcast today made possible by Grant.